I'd like to bring to order the Energy Utilities Technology and Communications Committee meeting. And I'm hoping that our remaining members will filter in here very quickly. We have three bills up today, and Senator John Dahl has the first two. So at this time, do you prefer to start with Senate File 2786, Senator Dahl?
Madam Chair, that's correct. I'd prefer to start. I think it leads the way for the second bill, so we could. So thank you, and members, thank you very much. What we're doing here with this bill is revolves around energy efficiency and renewable energy as we try to get more tools out in the marketplace to get folks to invest in their homes, their buildings, whether it's workplace or at home. And we feel that some of these mechanisms that we've got before us today here are going to help facilitate that. The 2720 is modeled after a popularly called at this point PACE, which is a property assessed clean energy financing mechanism. It's got a lot of different names, but specifically designed to help us make energy efficiency and renewable energy investments less expensive, more effective, and maybe a bit easier to implement, and to really just to increase the amount that we're investing into those areas. And it's around the general concept that's fairly familiar, which is special assessment taxing on a property tax. With a typical assessment district for a local government issues a bond to fund projects for a public purpose, such as streetlights or sewer systems, maybe underground utility lines. The property owners benefit from the improvement, then they repay that bond through the property assessments and secured by a property lien and paid as a part of the property tax. And that's the essential idea surrounding this approach to do it with energy efficiencies and renewable energy projects. I have a couple of testifiers before I go through the bill specifically. I thought maybe we'd bring up our testifiers and hear from them. And we'd start with Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities, if that's acceptable.
Okay, Mr. Johnson, come to the table, and I'd like to indicate that we have a quorum at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl, do you have an author's amendment on this bill?
Oh, I'm sorry. I do. I mean, we should start off with that. I do have to get it into the shape that we would like it in, I do have an author's amendment and like to move that at this time. It's a delete all, so I don't know if I have the number here.
No, author's amendments can be on the table.
That's A3 amendment. Been through a few evolutions in the language, and I think we've got it almost in the shape that we want it to for the full ride.
Okay. Does everybody have a copy of the amendment at this time? Okay. Senator Dahl moves the A3 amendment, an author's amendment. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
I'd like to turn it over at this time, Madam Chair, to Craig Johnson.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. It's my pleasure to be here today supporting Senator Dahl's legislation for an alternative way to finance individual improvements for energy efficiency and renewable energy at the...
Yeah, I stop you just for a minute. I thought we were starting with 2786, but we are starting with 2720.
2720.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sorry. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
No problem, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. This bill represents a very useful potential tool for local governments. While the economy right now doesn't put this in a particularly high demand, I think it will be very quickly, and I'll explain why. Cities, as I think most of you know, are both under a lot of pressure with renewable energy and other energy goals in the state, but also just from their constituents to be leaders on environmental issues, on energy issues, and in a time when finances are in a nearly impossible state for local government, that can be a very difficult thing to do. This gives an opportunity where people can individually choose to act on their homes and their businesses to make improvements, and the local government can play a role in assisting them to achieve the financing they need to do that in a way that is both financially viable for the cities because they don't have to go into a capital venture on their own, and does not strain the resources and the equity of the people who are doing the borrowing, because it's done as a special assessment on their property. So we are very excited that this could turn in over the next few years to something that will work in a number of communities. It's completely voluntary. Communities can choose to do this if they think it's a good tool for their community. And it only applies to individuals who petition to be part of the project. Nobody will ever have a special assessment on them because their neighbor decided to put solar panels up. So it really just seems like a common sense way to try and structure other opportunities for people to do financing of things that really right now are limited heavily because of their initial capital costs. So we appreciate the effort. We will continue working with the author to make sure all of the functions of how the special assessment work are effective for local governments, both for cities and counties.
Mr. Johnson, will it require the city councils to adopt new ordinances in order to utilize this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. The local governments that do this would have to take action to create a program, and they would then again have to take action to determine that they were going to sell revenue bonds and declare the special assessments on the properties that qualified for those. So there would be several steps where local governments would have to take proactive decision to move forward with this.
Okay. Other questions or comments?
Chair?
Senator
Messina. Thank you, Madam Chair. I got to go to the League of Minnesota Cities, I think, about a week ago and saw a presentation on this, and I was very impressed. But I'm a little upset right now, Madam Chair, because I live in a township, and I would love to do something like this. And so I'm wondering if the language, because my understanding was before they weren't sure what the local unit would be broken down, if it would be county, city, or depending on what part of the state, if it might be like even a rural economic development commission or something. So as this thing goes forward, are you looking at maybe as a pilot in cities and maybe possible expansions to larger areas if it's working? Or what about us out in the townships, John?
Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, you pointed out the one area that we certainly need a little bit more work on. Next stop after this, or pass through this committee, is state and local government. And those particular mechanisms, we have an ongoing discussion as to how that should be set up. And it requires a little more discussion than we were able to get through before the hearing here. But it's certainly the one area that we will be working on, so that those levels of government or units of local government or authorities, whether they be port authorities or CDAs or townships, you know, they can access it if they would like to, and they can make a resolution to do so. We're not sure if we should stop that at the county or at the state level as far as where those revenue bonds would originate from. But those are the one area of this that we'll still be doing a little more discussion on, and we'll have before the next hearing that figured out.
So you might be broadening the scope of this then?
A little bit. In terms of just how the mechanics of how it would work with the cities and the counties and those different levels of government to administer this. It's not quite clear with the different parties how, you know, where that should fall. You know, there's different models across the country of how this is done, and we want to make sure it works for Minnesota. We want to make it prescriptive enough so that, you know, the different levels of government are empowered to be able to move forward, but also enough flexibility there so that we're not locking anybody into one particular avenue or another.
Okay. Mr. Johnson.
And Madam Chair, I would just add to that. We actually had talked with the senator. It's why I said we're going to continue working. Many of my cities actually would prefer to work on this through their county because they're smaller cities and really won't have probably enough projects to be a good revenue bond purchase. They'd be better off if they were clumped together as a county or with a couple counties. Which would, of course, then allow them to include townships and other areas in eligible projects. But some cities are more than capable of having a successful operation of this program on their own. And we just want to make sure that in empowering counties to also have a program, we don't put it in a situation where counties suddenly have to have the program and cities can't do one at a lower level. So that's all we're trying to work out, is to make sure we don't have any unintended consequences.
Okay, and you'll be working on that as the bill moves along,
Chair,
to
yes,
other
we will.
Committees.
Yes.
Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dahl. This pretty interesting bill. It has lots of potential. Under the definition in Subdivision 5, you talk about qualifying real property. Will it be up to the cities or whatever local government unit to define who qualifies? I imagine because loans are involved, that homeowners will have to have some qualifying credentials. Or
Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, that's the idea here is to, you know, at this point, I'd like to leave that local level where these things are originating, have the flexibility to find what qualifies as a project.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess on that same vein, and Senator Dahl and I have talked about it a little bit, but I guess I'd like to have the testifier answer. Just how do you plan on doing that kind of qualification? Are you going to add staff to do it? And these are primarily technical projects. Will you be relying on your own staff to be able to verify these as good investments? Obviously, there's going to be a lot of demand for this, and you're going to have contractors that will come up with, obviously, a very good story and homeowners that would like to borrow money this way. But how do you verify that this is indeed a good technical project to put together?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator, most cities that I know of that would want to be involved in this will be spending quite a bit of time in designing that program to target the kinds of opportunities where they want to exercise this funding option. And I think one of the requirements that's in here that will be really important for my city folks is the requirement that it include a review of an energy audit, which will very specifically look at what is the cost effectiveness of that given energy improvement. Is it really one that makes sense to finance in this way? And, of course, most importantly, can a 20-year special assessment pay off the capital costs at a reasonable rate that is affordable to the property owner? Or are we going to end up with an assessment cost so high that it's not a reasonable program? Mm-hmm. So those will have to be looked at, I think, mostly in the design stage of the program. If they set up a program that's going to take extra staff, they're going to have to figure out a way to include those costs. There's room within special assessments for some administrative costs, but I think people would not be very happy. It's a voluntary program. People aren't going to volunteer for a program where they see a large chunk of the costs are going to be tied up in administrative costs. So I think local governments are going to have to find the balance there of how much time to spend on review and how much of that to do through contractors that will bring in the bids and show the cost effectiveness.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, what was your name again?
Mr. Johnson, Craig Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. In the case of, we've got three major categories here, the photovoltaic, the solar heating, and energy efficiency. And obviously energy efficiency is something that you can easily figure out how to pay back. You'll also have perhaps utilities involved in the assessment. But when you get to solar heating, there's a lot of care and maintenance that has to happen with solar heating. And many of the solar heating projects that we've seen, they get abandoned. And they, you know, for instance, Honeywell had a huge one on top of their parking ramp, and they abandoned it after about 5 years. These are the kinds of things that people enter into without actually knowing what the real payback is and also what the operational costs are. Photovoltaic, it doesn't pay off. I mean, it's a labor of love. It's something that you really want to do, but it doesn't have a payback. So what you might find is a lot of people that might abandon it after a time. And I see in there that it says that the city cannot raise taxes to pay back the bond. And so what happens when someone decides to either they're foreclosed on or they get out of the house or something and they don't pay this back?
Mr. Carlson? I mean, Johnson, I'm sorry.
It's fine. Madam Chair and Senator, I can take a first shot at this. My specialty, to be clear, is not special assessment financing. I work on primarily energy and environment policy. But because of the special assessment financing mechanism, the attachment of that special assessment as a lien on the property would allow the repayment of that to come through in the lien collection process of a foreclosure or of an abandonment. That's the primary safety mechanism that we feel makes this a viable revenue bond option for cities. And people who have far more expertise in how these work can certainly answer those questions.
Somebody is stepping up who must know.
Madam Chair, yes. John Herman is also one of my testifiers here. I think this would probably be a good time to have him bring his expertise to the table and might answer some of these particular questions.
Okay, although Senator Kevin Dahl had a question. Do you want to wait on that?
Madam Chair, I think it was answered. It was a little bit about administrative costs that a city might incur, and so I think he answered that question. Thanks.
Okay. Mr. Herman?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Herman. I'm a lawyer at Fagrey & Benson. I practice in the real estate and development finance areas and have had actually fairly long history with the legislature on energy legislation. My wife and I met with respect to the first energy agency bill that was passed in 1975. She was working for the then president of the Senate, Alec Olson. I still have a very nice picture of the bill signing. My testimony is, I would say, on behalf of two organizations, the Jobs Coalition, which I've worked with since its inception a year and a half or 2 years ago when we realized the catastrophic problems of development related to real estate in the state. And, of course, it's a very broad-based coalition of development authorities, cities, contractors, architects, and developers. But also, in a way, it's kind of personal testimony. I've actually had quite a bit of experience with the use of these Chapter 429 special assessment mechanisms on some of the prior examples of the use of this to encourage appropriate development activities in private property. And it engendered for me the idea that this could be a way to dramatically improve our success ratio in energy conservation improvements and in conversion to energy efficient and renewable systems. Let me tell you a little bit about my prior experience, because I think in a way it's responsive to the question, and then try to direct it more specifically to the energy. I've had quite a number of clients who over the years have used the 429 mechanism, which currently provides for special assessment bonding for skyways to finance the cost of private skyway construction in the downtown areas of cities in the state. And, of course, they are revenue bonds, as this provides, and they're financed then by special assessments. It's a way to get a very capital-intensive project to happen in a timely fashion and spread the costs of it over its reasonable, useful life in terms of improving the building value. And I've seen it used a number of times in that regard. Frankly, in most of those cases, because they're large projects, the financing is done individually. So a single project proposer will agree to the special assessment, and then the project will happen. Recently, however, we've had a very, very significant increase in the number of jurisdictions, cities, and watershed districts that, as many of you know, have required on-site water ponding systems to reduce runoff, and these are often expensive. We've also had a huge effort in the older cities to separate storm sewers and
Mr. Herman,
and water.
Please keep your testimony just to the bill at the present.
Okay. So in these cases, 3 or 4 years ago, the legislature added this kind of authority. And so these 429 bonds have been used and offered as a device for cities to do these kind of improvements, meaning that individual landowners didn't face a terrible capital cost with no device for solving it. And I think exactly the same thing's happening with energy. There are all kinds of energy improvements that are of high public virtue and save money and increase the value of the property, and they have capital costs, and there's no way to obtain loans for these generally in the market. And so allowing them to be done this way is a very efficient device. because the price of the financing is economical. The term over which they can be spread is reasonably related, and they are the priority repayment obligation after your property taxes of a general nature. And so the security for the repayment is extremely strong. There's still revenue bonds in this proposal, so there's not general obligation, but they would have to be paid back. I've had several clients of a larger commercial nature who have said to me, since this has been floating around the legislature, this would be incredibly valuable as a device for allowing us to do major either energy conservation improvements or improvements that would, for example, do a geothermal heating system. I have a couple of specific comments.
I think that's okay. We just need to understand the gist of it, and there are some questions at this time. Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Merman, is it?
Herman.
Herman, I'm sorry. Since you're the real estate expert, one thing occurred to me, what if somebody comes in, buys their house, 10% down FHA, and then puts like $130,000 house and then puts $40,000 in a solar panel on the roof? And that gets in front of the mortgage, doesn't it?
It does, but Senator Vanderveer, that's correct, and that's why you don't want this to be solely at the discretion of the individual owner. You want it to be done as part of a program where it's required that you have a competent engineering analysis and you have a demonstration that there's actually an economic benefit overall, so that the person is saving money compared to what they would do otherwise. And one of the things that I think the League and other groups are thinking of doing is, how do you do this and put together the programmatic work so that it's done in a fashion where every individual city isn't reinventing the wheel? The League often offers a kind of template or a service where they say, here's a way to do this. And nobody is going to buy these bonds unless you have that kind of a structure where you can actually make certain that the investment is an economic one. And I don't know if that's a perfect answer to Senator Carlson's question, but I think it's a large part of the answer. No one is going to programmatically allow a very large and capital-intensive investment that doesn't have a payback that's reasonable, where you actually increase the cash flow of the business or increase the amount of money available to the homeowner.
Senator Vanderveer, Mr. Fuller has a response for you, too.
Madam Chair, Senators, if you turn to page 2, line 27 and 28, regards your question of priority. The priority for the loan will only be to the extent of the default, so there's no acceleration. So if you're 2 years into the loan and you had you owe $2,000, even though the principal loan is 20, that the rest of it doesn't jump ahead. So you can't foreclose. It's not an acceleration. So that's a protection to the mortgager that Senator Dahl wanted in the bill.
Senator Alcine.
Well, Madam Chair, would I be reading this correctly on page 3.1, that it talks about 10% or lesser of 10%? So there is a cap on the amount of the project. So there should be some balance between the equity in the home and the investment in the project. So I think that's kind of a protection in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, thank you. There's another speaker, Bill Haney.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bill Haney, Legislative Director for the IBEW Minnesota State Council. I'm here today to testify in support of the bill. You have the AFL-CIO letter that was distributed indicating that fully utilized, the program could get about 1,200 people to work, and that's an exciting prospect for all of us. Just by way of anecdote, my daughter lives out in one of the suburbs of Boulder. I was talking to her the other day, and she said, Boulder, Colorado, said that They were looking at a program just like this and would be eligible for up to $15,000 in energy improvements to their home. And we're very excited about doing some windows and some insulation work to improve the energy efficiency of their home. So.
Any comments, questions? Thank you, Mr. Haney. Well, Senator Dahl?
Madam Chair, I will go briefly through this and answer any other questions that my members might have. But again, as has been heard, right now we've got this set up as a city program, and you would have to do energy efficiencies before you go into any renewable energy projects. So those are being taken care of. We also want to make sure that we're working with the local utilities to maximize any of the additional monies that are out there, or to coordinate the programs that they have existing for SIP and other projects and rebates, and maximizing those efforts. And then, again, working through the cities as they would qualify it, so they'd have to approve the program through their city council. There is loan provisions in here in terms of the amount of value, you know, the loan itself to the value of the property. We don't want to have a negative equity position on the property. We'd like to show that they have the ability to repay the loan. And the idea, again, is to simply be able to aggregate these projects in a way that allows them to take advantage of any energy efficiencies or programs that they wouldn't be able to because they couldn't come up with the money up front. At the end of it, the other idea here that is that to give it some value on subdivision 5 of on page 3 is simply that at the end of the program, upon completion of the project, the city would issue the borrower certificate stating they participated in the program, that they've gone through the energy audit, that they've had qualified contractors doing the work, that that it was looked at and verified that the work was done in an appropriate manner. And those energy savings hopefully can be verified so that that can be used at a point maybe where if they were to sell the home or the business, that could be a tool that they could be used to show that that this was done, as well as the value that's increased in the property. So and at that point, the decision could be made whether to include that in the agreement, the terms of the buyout, or if the new homeowner would or business owner would continue the payments. But in general, that's the gist of the bill. And I stand ready for any questions.
Any questions? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. or Madam Chair, and Senator Dahl. What I'm sitting here struggling with on a kind of a personal basis, I was a city council member for 11 years, and it just seems to me, just fundamentally, that you know, cities have a role in the life of its citizenry, and so do financial lending institutions. Why would cities want to become financial lending institutions if I'm understanding the bill correctly? It just seems to me, fundamentally, this is not the role of government. But help me understand why it might be.
Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, what we're trying to do here is put some tools out there in the marketplace. And, you know, right now, especially with credit being so tight and, you know, personally trying to get out personal credit to be the mechanism to whether you would get a loan to do some of these projects, makes it onerous for a lot of folks and businesses to actually do any of these things. This is a mechanism that, under the right circumstances, could allow those businesses or homeowners to proceed with a project. And all communities have, interest in seeing that their community gets better, that it's going to be improved some way, whether it's in their streets or it's in individual properties. And this option enables some of these businesses to be, and homeowners to do a project that they normally in other ways may not be able to do so. And so this is not putting the liability on the city or the county, but it's enabling them through their local authority to allow this to happen and put it onto their property tax. The homeowners, it's private money. The homeowner will be, you know, getting the bond and having to take care of the payments. The city is not liable for those things. So it's, in a sense, I guess you could look at it as being they're a banker, but they do bonding for other issues too. And in case of, say, my city in Burnsville,
They tell me that if they were to take on this program, they probably would go through the Community Development Agency to actually administer the program, but be the access point to for the bonds themselves. In Boulder, Mr. Haney had pointed out, what they're doing there is they'll go out and have the county will have like an RFP. They'll have open up a window of when we'll accept applications for this type of financing. And when that window closes, they'll take and aggregate all of those together, then go and issue the bonds for those that amount. And I think they're on their third round financing at this point. The other option would be to have just an open-end, like a line of credit, that as these projects came forward, they could qualify them and then issue the bond for the appropriate amount for that particular project. But simply put, it's a tool that if the cities find it's appropriate and they want to enter into this particular setup, that they have the enabling language to allow them to do that.
It's not very much. It's not different from properties where they want to bring gas lines or water lines or
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
The property or do street improvements in front of the property. It's just a vehicle that the city can use to assist the homeowner. And it's to the city's advantage to have those improvements made, too.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair,
Senator Sanchez.
Is the fundamental advantage, though, just a lower interest rate, a cheaper loan? Is that fundamentally what you get out of this?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Sanchez, not necessarily. I mean, it doesn't mean that the interest rate's going to be lower. There's still a market rate on the interest rates, though. Right now, I know that the federal government is working on things that they've got some grants and the like that they're working on, and possibly be some federal loan guarantees that could bring the interest rates down. But that's not necessarily the case. It's a tool that just allows that if you can't come up with all of the money initially up front, you have a vehicle to put it on your property tax, and it stays with the property and not with you as the owner of that property. It's also not necessarily tied to your personal finance and your credit history, so that if you don't have the means to actually borrow the money based on your personal credit, it's on the property, the value of the property itself. And we're leveraging the fact that it generally increases the value, and it's a public good to raise the value of the homes and the energy efficiency of these homes. By putting the parameters in there that the amount that you're saving off the energy, it's repurposing the dollars that are already out there that we're using to pay for energy in our homes and our businesses, and taking those savings, and that it's not that you will, you know, have enough to do that, but you should be able to pay for that regardless. But if we're doing it properly, the amount that you're saving and your energy now can be is equal to or greater than the amount that you're paying in that increased loan on the property. So that's the idea. So just another tool that in the right circumstances folks could use.
It's a more secured loan for one, but it also can be extended out for a longer period of time for the mm-hmm. for the life of the solar panel, for
right.
instance.
And Madam Chair,
so that it can be paid off at a lower principals on an annual basis.
Madam Chair and Senator Sanchez, also with the fact that it is in on the property like this, that the bond holders, those folks are more likely to engage in selling these bonds. It seems that that's the next bill that I have up is actually a bill that's been before this committee, and it's a microenergy loan based on revenue bonds. And without having something that gives them a little more some more guarantees, a lot of the bond holders don't want to issue those bonds or buy those bonds. So this gives us a little more stability and guarantees for those that money to be loaned out.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Senator Carlson.
And Senator Dahl, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dahl, we're talking about this as being, in essence, a home improvement loan. If I need to have, or if I want to put on onto my house a geothermal heating system, I think you're saying that would probably qualify. Probably some more efficient windows, that would probably qualify. How about if I need a new furnace? Would that qualify? Is that the kind of thing we're thinking about?
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, it could be. I mean, again, cities will have will set up the parameters as what they believe would be a qualifying project. They'll work with the utilities as well to set up this project so that, you know, if that's something that they determine would be a qualifying project, they could do so. As Vince mentioned about what is a qualifying contractor, standards as far as what an efficiency means, there are standards within the state here that, you know, the builders associations and the like that are already using certain standards. It'll probably be looked at as a benchmark or base as to where we go, you know, and how those programs will be set up on the local level. But again, we want to give enough direction within this language to allow the municipalities or the whatever level would operate this program be empowered to move forward, but not so prescriptive that, you know, one size isn't going to fit all. There's got to be some flexibility so that they can determine what's appropriate for their municipality.
And Madam Senator Chair, Carlson. Senator Dahl, then the onus for qualifying these would be firstly on the owner, property owner themselves, and then it would be to the municipality, whether it be county, city. They would have the exclusive responsibility to qualify these, and because it's either the owner's property or the city's bonds that are being obligated. Is that correct then? That's
Senator
exclusive
Carlson,
obligation.
That is correct.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Senator Dodd?
Well, Madam Chair, then members, I would move that 2720 as amended be recommended to pass and referred, I believe, to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Okay, on that motion, any questions or comments? Then all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Dahl, you have a
thank you, Madam Chair. The next bill I have is Senate File 2780, and I'll bring my testifiers up.
2786.
2786. And again, this is a bill that was actually has been enacted into law. We're making some upgrades to it. It passed through this committee a couple of years ago. I think Senator Rosen was the chief author on the bill, and Senator Dibble has also very influential in the development of the bill. And what we've done is expanded it, I think added some provisions in here that allows it to, you know, open it up to more possibilities of folks taking advantage of the microenergy loan program, and also kind of dusting off, repackaging it a little bit, and in conjunction with this PACE financing model, if that were to go through and be enacted into law, that I'd also give it a little more support and you know, reason for bond companies to engage in this. What we've done with this bill is basically open it up from renewable energy only, small renewable energy projects, to energy efficiency as well. We've also expanded it from just small businesses to property owners in general. We've also increased the amount that of revenue bonds that could be sold from $20 million to $100 million. And, again, we want to make sure that we work with the utilities on this program. One of the other provisions in here, line 1.12, letter B of subdivision 3, is that they could also do renewable energy improvements or energy conservation programs to little larger scale projects like campuses, neighborhoods, industrial parks, and subdivisions. Now, I thought I had an amendment for this one as well.
Okay, Mike.
I do have an amendment, yes. And Madam Chair, I would like to, again, this is the first stop this has had, if I could move that amendment to address a couple of issues that we had had in the bill that get in the shape that I'd like it in. It's the A1 amendment.
So on Senator Dahl's author's amendment, the A1 amendment, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members know what that is when talking with utilities, we we want to make sure that we're not setting up a bunch of small energy generating companies all over the metro area or around the state, and that we're competing with the service territories that are already in place, and with and we want them to work with the utilities. And so what we want to, what the language says, the projects may not sell, transmit, or distribute the electrical energy at retail, and may not provide for end use from an off-site facility of the electrical energy. And on-site generation is allowed only to the extent provided in 216B. So it's there's net metering that's already allowed, and so this is just so that we're working with the utilities and not overstepping our boundaries or existing law on service territories. And with that, if I may, Madam Chair, I'd like to have Lynn Hinkle provide a little additional testimony.
Senator Dahl, do you know how much of these micro-energy loans have been issued in the past?
Madam Chair, yes, I do. Zero.
Do you know why?
I've been told, Madam Chair, that it's a soft bond market when they first came out. And so then I think once that they didn't really take off, you know, it just kind of, the interest in it died, and there was no, you know, they didn't know the program was there. I don't know how much promotion was done on the program. I also understand from talking with others that if, you know, we had a little more of a guarantee, like with this PACE loan financing program, that there might be more interest to buy these bonds.
Do you know how long this tool has been here?
I believe it's been 2 years, okay. Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Hinkle.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn. Excuse me. My name is Lynn Hinkle. I'm with the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association. We represent solar installers across the state, electrical contractors who are engaged in solar installations, manufacturers of products for solar thermal, solar PV and their components and utilities, as well as unions, workforce development, institutions that are training people for these good green jobs that are developing in the solar and renewable economy. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. I'd like to emphasize that aspect of this bill. It's a jobs bill. It's a jobs creation bill. Senate File 2720 provides an opportunity for investments in energy efficiency and solar voltaic, we call it PV, technologies, as well as solar thermal. An investment of $100 million in local clean revenue bonds in voluntary assessment districts throughout the state could improve 0.5%. We think that's a fairly realistic figure of residential property via energy efficiency and solar PV technologies with an equal amount.
Mr. Hinkle, we're on 2786, a different bill.
That's correct. That's correct. The amount that would be created by the funds that would be generated with the bonding in this is what I'm addressing, so you're correct. I misspoke.
Okay.
The funds that would be created through the microenergy loan and bond program would have the effect of creating 1,200 jobs directly in this state, and we're not taking into account any of the potential multipliers with indirect or induced jobs. We're just looking at the number of jobs that would be created directly through the issuance of bonds under the provisions of this bill. I'd like to, you know, talk briefly about what I see as the real potential of expanding and utilizing the microenergy loan and bond capacity. And I think it goes to the question that Senator Olsen raised earlier, that this allows greater capacity. And it allows the state, in effect, to become the aggregator. So in the case of a township or in the case of rural counties that may not have the capacity to aggregate or may not have the number of projects to move forward and justify the issuance of bonds themselves, they would be able to use this program, and the state would intervene in that situation as the supplier, as the issuer of bonds, so that they could move forward. It becomes, in effect, the aggregator in those situations. We believe that this would be an effective tool, a complement, and as Senator Dahl has stated a couple of times, this just gives another tool to cities and counties, townships. It may be joint powers arrangements between counties, and PACE itself gives those cities and counties and other jurisdictions significant tools, so that in turn it gives residents, the people that we serve, more tools for doing energy improvements themselves.
Senator Dahl, if $20 million has never been issued, why would they issue $100 million?
Well, Madam Chair, that's a good question. I don't know that they'll issue any more bonds at this point. No one's using the program, and we figured, well, at this point, with the introduction of this PACE legislation, I expect that we can move this forward. I've gotten a lot of support from all areas, that there's going to be a buzz that's created because of that. I think the microenergy loan program was a good idea 2 years ago. I think it's still a good idea. I don't know if it was simply the soft bond market that was part of it, or if it's the focus
maybe,
that was it. But
maybe Mr. DeFebri can help us
maybe
understand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremy DeFebri, and I'm with the Office of Energy Security. And if we were to request the bonds to be sold under this, it would likely be a program that my staff would operate. The issue has been that the way the program is structured in the current bond market, you are in soliciting a variety of proposals from multiple local governments. You are aggregating a lot of risk that the market does not have an appetite to buy right now, or at least at a price that would be competitive. So what might be different is with a PACE backed project for these bonds, you are significantly lowering perceived risk.
Madam Chairman?
So, Mr. DeFebri, is this something then that you favor, that you're likely to issue? Are you looking for direction? I got that.
I'll get back to you on that.
Mr. Hinkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps as a way of answering that, I could refer back to the program that has been launched and is running in Boulder County. Boulder decided to solicit applications for their program and then released a bond based on the strict subscription pool that had been identified. The results, $9.55 million in the first round of funding, and that included 519 properties who were signed up. So you've got a bond that's fit exactly to the definition or to the pool of people who have signed up, voluntarily sought out participation in this program. And I think that speaks to the reluctance on the part of the market previous to this, that would be removed, that you can see how that repayment mechanism is secured through the pool of qualified applicants who have been aggregated for this program. In the second round of funding, just about an equal amount of bonds were issued.
Mr. Hinkle, are you suggesting that this bond fund could be used to pay for the other program that was discussed in the previous bill?
That's correct.
I don't think that's possible.
Madam Chair, my understanding is that is possible, but I would have to refer to counsel. But after my discussions with the Office of Energy Security, that there's a possibility that because
they would loan the money to the local government.
Because of that structure, those bondholders or the who would be selling the bonds would. Be more, they reduce the risk, and so
is there somebody that could speak to that? Yeah. Director Glahn?
Madam Chair, Senators, if I could revise and extend my shrug from a few moments ago. My recollection of this originally started out as an agency initiative a couple years ago, and we were pleased that Senator Rose and I believe it was Representative Magnus in the House carried the bill on our behalf and got this thing into law. We had high hopes for it to work, and despite the diligent efforts of Mr. DeFebri and his staff to try to get the $20 million out there and doing good for our homeowners and communities, you know, it hit that, when we were trying to get the thing off the ground, it was right around September, October of 2008, not a good time to be trying to float bonds in the credit market. So our timing couldn't have been worse in that respect. So notwithstanding specific concerns we might have about the language of the bill and amendment and how we would tie together this with some other program, we would like to see the microenergy loan program work. And at least the way we have it constituted today, we haven't been able to get it off the ground. And rather than just spend another couple of years floundering with a program that we don't think is going to be received well in the marketplace, we'd like to try to tinker with it, to try to a little different approach to see if we could make it work. Back to your specific question about combining these two programs, we would have to go back and take a look at the specific language to see if that would be permitted, and beyond that to see if that's a particularly cost-effective way of doing it. It might be that having them as standalone programs would work better, and there's a slightly different purpose, I think, at work for each of them. So I hesitate to say, yes, we could combine them. Yes, that's a good idea. We should do that. It's something that we could take a look at, but I think the bottom line is we'd like to try something different because what we have in place as useful as we thought it would be a couple of years ago and as committed to we are to getting it going hasn't been able to work.
So are Mr. Glahn, do you see this microenergy loan program being a supplier for the previous bill to the local units of government?
Madam Chair, that's not how I've thought of it.
I don't think the bill is
I've thought of them
as
separate
either.
Programs, but if we could find a way to combine them or to weave them together and that proves to be effective, cost-effective, and logistically effective, something we'll take a look at.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Probably would be helpful if Mr. Herman were here at this time, but I'm suggesting that probably people would do better in your first bill trying to get their funds through.
Yeah. Well, I just, Madam Chair, if I might, they are designed to be separate bills. So it's just that there's a possibility with the space financing, my understanding that it may improve the chances of the microenergy loan program working with the PACE financing out there. But really, they're designed to be still standalone pieces.
Okay. Senator Jungbar had a question, then Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dahl and or Council, anybody could answer this, but I'm a little concerned with the A1 amendment. And so I need some clarification. Line 1.5, where it says projects may not sell, transmit, or distribute the electrical energy at retail and may not provide for end use from an off-site facility of the electrical energy. And on-site generation is allowed to the extent of Section 216B. Where I need the clarification is I know there's a lot of potential projects from cities and counties right now in terms of economic development where they're trying to work towards carbon-neutral, carbon-negative business parks where they want to generate, whether it's biomass energy or coal gasification, and create business parks around that. Would that mean under this that they couldn't sell that energy to those consumers, the business owners at retail, if they use this program or in general using things? And I think that kind of defeats the whole purpose when we talk about, because I know there's quite a number of counties and cities looking at creating these types of systems under a renewable energy type of a program, and the market hasn't been right, so it's kind of concerning there on how that works.
Mr. Evans, are you here to answer that question?
Madam Chair, yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. Madam Chair, Senator, currently the utilities in Minnesota operate under exclusive service territories, and this language merely reiterates what is currently the law. Unless you're a public utility, you're not permitted to sell electric energy in Minnesota at retail. This is really sort of, I guess, belts and suspenders sort of language to make sure that no one enters this program with the understanding that they can put up a generating station and then go out and sell their electricity at retail, because they can't unless they're a regulated public utility.
Senator Jungbaum.
And Madam Chair, I believe that there are a lot of programs moving forward where they don't really understand that, so that's kind of what I was trying to get to, and I assume that's what this language was doing. And I don't know to what extent this committee has looked at those boundary lines, because I've looked at them specifically around Minnesota, and it's perplexing, Mr. Evans, as to how those boundary lines originally came, because it looked like, you know, Elmer had his farm here and so-and-so served it, so now we got a boundary line there, and those boundary lines also are a hindrance long-term for some of these programs. XL, you have great programs available, but if you just happen to be next door to XL and in, say, East Central's area, there's a whole different level of service that's available, and I don't know how we overcome some of those things, but I just use that as an example because that's one of the craziest boundary line systems I've seen. But they exist all over the state, and so I think there's other problems, and as we talk about transmission and generation and renewables and how some of these people are looking at projects, I don't think people really understand all the number of different things we're looking at potentially conflicting with here on these programs.
Senator Jungbaum, you're an author on this bill.
on the 27.
No. Madam Chair, he signed on before we put the amendment.
Before we put the amendment on, yes. And I thought it was 2720 I was the author on. Oh.
I don't know if you want to make a response. I know that Senator Dibble wants to.
It's not to this point, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there a response to be made?
Well, I guess I,
Mr. Evans,
Madam Chair, I just say that, you know, there are processes in the state of Minnesota by which one utility can acquire service territory under some circumstances from other utilities, based on what the customer might want, and really a whole set of legal precedents that are set up to establish that. And you know, the exclusive service territory provisions in our statutes, which are essentially the things that make us monopolies within our service territory, which is essentially why we're rate-regulated utilities. So you want to dive into all that, you know, you're welcome and good luck.
Madam Chair, I was just really trying to get the committee and others to understand as we go into these, and as I've been working with different communities around the state, I really don't think a lot of people have a concept of all the different controls that are in place and the statutes are in place, and I think we do have people moving forward on things without understanding that, so we do need to make sure. So I assumed that was why it was there, and I didn't really have a problem with it, but I'm trying to bring that forward because I don't think a lot of communities really understand that you can do what they're thinking about doing.
And Senator Jungbar, Mr. Fuller advises me that this same language has been used in a number of other bills. Senator Dole.
Thanks, Madam Chair. But actually, I do have a question at this point, but then I have an observation on the earlier discussion. This does not, however, prevent distributed energy generation at a particular site from selling back to the grid. I don't think that's the intent of the language.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Just getting back to the previous inquiry about whether or not this bill could inform or help fund or finance the work of the previous bill, I don't see a great conflict. I see a possibility. I do think, and I understand Senator Dahl's intention of keeping them as separate programs or standalone bills, but also letting one perhaps in some instances support the other. I do think there might need to be some bridging language in one or the other just to kind of make that clear, because I think when we're talking about the PACE legislation specifically drawn to revenue bonds issued by a municipality, the microenergy loans are about revenue bonds issued by the state, and I don't see the bridging there.
Except the first bill is so far superior. Why would they use the second bill?
Well, good question, and probably an answer for the marketplace to decide. Although,
right.
I do think Senator Rosen did fine work a couple of years ago. I happen to carry that as a provision. It was amended into a larger bill that I carried, so my name is attached to that work too. So I want to see that perhaps blossom if it possibly can.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was some reference to the public relations or the PR of the first of this bill, and I'd like to have a little more explanation, maybe from the department. Why did it need to be marketed a little bit more? It was just the bonds. What was the issue that it did not take off? I'd like to have a little more comfort on that one.
Mr. DeFebri.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. Without an ability to sell the bonds, there was not a program to market to the potential clients. And we have never been in a position, as the program was structured, to have a saleable bond. But that's been the advice we have gotten from Deputy Commissioner Cardell at MMB, who's the Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management, that they are not saleable.
Madam Chair, and so on the
Senator
first
Rosen.
Bill, the PACE bill, the marketing of that would be done by the individual, the city?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, that's what would be my understanding, is that, you know, those municipalities or local units of government that would engage in this and set this program up, that's would be part of what they would be doing, I would expect, is to market that to homeowners or businesses within their jurisdiction.
Okay. Madam Chair, well, thank you, Senator Dahl, for getting this rounded up, and thank you for the department, too. It's a good program.
I didn't mean to slam you, Senator Rosen. I know that you do a great job with your bills. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just thinking about what Senator Jungbauer said and Mr. Evans, and what you said, and thinking about, okay, what does this do that the other one doesn't, and trying to understand the application to kind of community projects. And I see this as intended to focus on not just one house. I mean, that if you can get a neighborhood together, an industrial park. So what are, if you were to do that and get the loan to do that, I mean, it would be hard to do that through property tax assessment in a broad, or maybe it could be done in some cases, but what are the restrictions? I mean, could that be done without violating this exclusive monopoly restriction? I mean, as long as you're not selling it at retail, could you borrow money to build a community energy facility and provide energy to a group of people in a suburban development or in a part of downtown. I mean, we have district energy in St. Paul, but of course that's an exception to the monopoly status of the utility. So that was I think that was a specific law. District energy. I'm just asking how could communities use this without running afoul of what you're talking about? Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson. In the case of district energy, they produce electricity in their process and they sell it to Xcel Energy. So they don't sell it retail, they sell it wholesale. Right. And then we, in turn, sell that energy to our customers. And currently, that's the way small projects, whether they're seabed projects or other small projects, if they're not a public utility, they sign a power purchase agreement with the utility and they sell it to whatever utility is signed up to buy it, and then that utility turns around and sells it. So there's not a way to sell electricity at retail that I'm aware of in Minnesota unless you're a regulated public utility, co-op or a muni. However, you can set up a small project and sell power wholesale to the utility to be sold at retail.
So, Senator Madam Anderson. Chair and Senator Jungbauer, if you wanted to create an industrial park, you could do it that way, or a community project that was putting up a couple wind turbines to supply electricity to that neighborhood. You could do that, but you'd have to do it through the local utility through a power purchase agreement. So there's still, that's how this would work, right? I mean, this current bill, that's kind of intended for that purpose. Okay.
Absolutely.
Be clear. Thank you.
Senator Olsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, if I may. When Senator Jungbauer talks about a carbon neutral park, it's in my district that they're talking about, and they've worked with the Swedes quite a bit. And in Sweden, I guess it's not uncommon to have 100 homes on a central heating system, and it might be where they gasify the wood and they produce the heat that way, but they also produce electricity that way that may be sold or distributed through that same area that's receiving the district heat. Would that be if something like that happened in Minnesota, because it'd be like a co-op or something, would that be exempt from Xcel's? Because if it's within their own organization, would that be different, or would they have to sell it back to the regulated utility and have it sold back?
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, that wouldn't be exempted. I mean, in a larger scale, what you're maybe talking about is like a municipal utility, which we have many of those around the state of Minnesota, where a municipality runs its own utility and they're subject to their own set of laws and regulations. But there's not a means other than that to do that. Now, district energy, for example, sells steam as sort of a distributed system, but steam is not regulated the way gas and electricity are. So that's the difference.
But maybe Mr. Galan has a different opinion.
No, I didn't know that Rick was going to finish with his last sentence, and so I was going to come in with that caveat that, as far as I know, that steam or hot water or chilled water or a lot of the other utilities that, say, they have in downtown and the district energy downtown St. Paul, or they have in downtown Minneapolis, those are utilities that a neighborhood could participate in that aren't rate regulated like electricity or natural gas. So steam or chilled water, hot water, those could be utilities that a neighborhood could participate in. And there are some exceptions at the federal level. Again, you'd have to consult a lawyer who's familiar with PURPA, that if you have a campus-like setting where you own the buildings and there's a common ownership and you have a facility that produced electricity, that the buildings on that campus could participate without falling afoul of the utility's exclusive service territory. But there's a test about contiguousness and ownership and all that. So I don't think you could, for example, put a solar panel on your roof and sell to your neighbor. But if you had a condo building and put it on the roof, that would be a different set of facts.
Madam Chair.
Okay, let's just have a couple more questions, and then we need to move on. Is this a follow-up in your last question?
This is actually back to the microenergy.
Senator Olsen.
I think I could get this thing going tomorrow if we could get a definition of conservation measures, because in my district there's there's an ice arena that has a geothermal system that they use to for producing their ice. So would that, could I get an interpretation if a geothermal system for an ice arena would fall in there? We could get this thing rolling real quick, because the Mighty Ducks bill, you know, there were so many people wanted the Mighty Ducks stuff that this might be an alternative financing for them.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, I don't see a problem with that, and certainly we could put a definition in there. I don't know if that would fall under renewable energy systems to begin with anyway. So,
but it's geothermal.
Yeah. But if, you know, again, I guess it would be maybe to the Office of Energy Security's definitions, too, if, you know, on how they're promoting it. But I don't see anything that precludes us from, you know, putting a definitions in here of some sort to give some parameters as to and guidance to move these things forward.
Madam Chair, I believe that if that were the case, I think it could really jump start the program.
Does that suggest that? Or publicly? Okay. Problem is they still aren't selling the bonds, so.
Those minor details.
But we set up the structure anyways.
Right.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Olsen, it's not just your district, actually. I work for an engineering company, and we've done like 8 RFPs around Minnesota. Within those RFPs, they come out and say what they're trying to accomplish in terms of these parks that they're trying to create.
I don't know.
And so I think, and so maybe it's a heads up to XL and other people that what we're hearing, I don't know, I'm hearing back from people that are actually participating in these power purchase agreements that, number one, nobody's settling them quickly, and when they are settling them, they're for extremely low amounts, and so people are trying to figure out other ways to skirt the system. And we've actually done some of these projects out of the state, and it kind of gets back to power purchase agreements versus net metering. So maybe as we're talking about some of these programs, I think it might be a good benefit to get some people that are looking at how they're going to use these micro energy programs or other things in these grants to get in here and talk about the problems they've had in the past and how we can mix all this together, because a lot of times we're talking on one bill or another and we don't have all the players in here that are thinking they might be able to use it and really don't understand all these different slices of the pie and requirements they have to meet. So I'm
Senator Dahl, there seem to be a lot of questions about your bill. I'm not sure if you feel it's ready to move on at this point or if you'd like to lay it over for further work.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm thinking some of these issues are separate issues from this bill. I know the bill's out there already, and it's, you know, it's not moving, you know, and we wanted to tweak it a little bit to see if we can't get some movement on it. The issues about whether power purchase agreements are being handled and negotiated in a fair way seems to be independent of this particular bill, you know, and that can be brought up another time. I'd still like to move it forward because I don't know that it has, you know, other than maybe making some definitions in here, I don't know how we can make it much better than what we have, because, like I say, at this point, it's not moving. There aren't, no one's selling or buying these bonds, so this would be an effort to just open it up, or, like say, dust it off a little bit and repackage it and put it back out there.
Senator Dahl, what if we just light it over while we come up with a definition for conservation?
Sure.
Improvement or conservation measures.
Okay.
And we could bring it up next week.
Okay.
Madam Chair, as a final comment is how that plays into this. If you think about it as a selling a bond and in terms of banking and security, if somebody that's buying the bonds doesn't believe there's enough money in the marketplace based on a power purchase agreement to get that payback long term, that's why you don't have any buyers for the bonds. So the way we negotiate power purchase agreements or net metering type of systems, that creates the market that we can get these projects out in, and so that does become a major effect on any of these types of programs in the bonds.
Out of the wide range, yeah. So.
Okay.
So
we'll just lay it over for right now, and you can do some more work on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And you and I can change places here now.
They could build the ice part with the geothermal system.
Yeah.
Senator Prettner-Solin, you have Senate file
2589. Okay, and the reason this bill is being brought forward at this time is that we have a number of transmission projects that we're trying to move forward, and there are lots of reasons why they're not moving as quickly as we'd like to see them move. But one of them is that the eminent domain process has been a problem in many areas and has slowed the process of getting those transmission projects up and running. And so this is an effort to define an area where transmission lines could go up without having to go through eminent domain, and it might make it easier for projects to locate this way too. So this bill attempts to balance the rights of property owners in the state of Minnesota with the need to have reliable electricity in the state. The CapEx 2020 lines are in different stages of permitting but are moving forward to meet the energy needs of our state. As these lines are going through this process of applying for site permits, landowners have been raising concerns about some of the proposed routes. We will be taking up a bill next month addressing the issue of eminent domain, and this has been around the legislature for a couple of years now, and it hasn't really been settled. So, however, despite this, we believe that before we can talk about landowner compensation issues, we need to do all that we can to minimize the taking of private land and maximize the use of publicly owned land that has already been condemned. This bill attempts to do just that by putting into law that it is a priority of the state for high voltage transmission to run along existing utility corridors and highway rights of way. I understand that this is not always feasible. Current law already requires that the PUC consider a number of criteria, including but not limited to environmental impacts, agricultural impacts, as well as consideration of problems raised by other state and federal agencies and local entities, to name just a few. And the purpose of this bill is twofold. First, we want the commission to prioritize routes that utilize existing utility corridors and rights of way. And second, we want to make sure that the Department of Transportation is a participant in the process to help identify how and where these lines can utilize existing rights of way. I'm encouraged to hear that the agency has been a good partner throughout the CapEx process. I want to make it clear that the intention of this bill is not to undermine the ability of MnDOT to protect the traveling public. In its current form, we believe it does not restrict their ability to fulfill their responsibility to the public. We will continue to work with MnDOT to try and find language that accommodates their concerns, but also accomplishes our goal of minimizing the taking of private land for much-needed electric transmission. With the projected transmission needs growing in the future, I believe this approach is the most responsible way to meet both the electric demands of our state and the rights of owners, of the landowners. And I do have an A1 amendment to that. It's an author's amendment that puts the bill in the shape that I would like it to be in. At this time, I offer the A1 amendment.
Senator Prettner-Solin offers the A1 amendment, author's amendment. Without any discussion, without that, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
We don't have it yet.
She's carrying it out right now. Okay.
Sorry.
Looks like
we like it.
We like it. Motion is adopted. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I have
thank you.
The PUC is here to provide a brief summary of the routing process for high voltage transmission lines. Okay. And then I've also invited XL Energy to speak on behalf of this bill.
So you may come to the table. Welcome to the committee, and for the record, please identify yourself, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon. My name is Brett Eckness. I'm a staff member at the Public Utilities Commission. The statute that is looking at being amended and which gives the commission the authority over these facilities is 216E. Okay. is 216E. The rules that implement that statute are Minnesota Rule 7850. Generally, the scope of the route proceeding is 100 kilovolts or more. The decisions of the commission preempt local jurisdiction or local regulations, and PUC route decisions also control or influence state agency permits. I have provided a flow chart of the route permitting process. It's a little bit small, as it is reproduced here. But nevertheless, if you look real close, you'll see some asterisks. And where those asterisks are, or asterisks, those are points in the process where the public can participate, and also agencies can also participate at those points and inform the commission as to their concerns. The state agencies, typically the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, and the Department of Transportation, their interests are affected by projects proposed before the commission. There are a couple of ways that the word gets out on transmission projects. The first would be the biennial transmission plan, which is a report filed by transmission owners in the state every odd year, and that looks at the reliability of the transmission system, and it tries to identify projects that will need to be proposed or in order to address different deficiencies. The other one the commission doesn't participate in, but nevertheless is very important, and that is the direct pre-application consultation that an applicant would have with the different agencies that are affected. Upon the route application being filed with the commission finding the application complete, the process begins by developing the environmental assessment, the scope of the environmental assessment. This is a point where the state agencies and the public can participate, provide their input, and also suggest alternatives to those proposed by an applicant. A couple of months after that, a draft environmental impact statement would be developed, and then that would be sent out for comment. State agency input, public input is appreciated at that point. A few months after that, then a final environmental impact statement is developed and put out. There are a couple of ways that an agency can participate. They can join if it's a contested case, and the CAPEX proceedings are all large enough where they are contested cases. A state agency can participate as a formal party, or it can merely participate and provide expert testimony based on the alternatives that are proposed and examined within the proceeding. I think the final page of my presentation indicates the points in the statute that address the issues that that are under consideration here. 216E03 subdivision 7. The PUC is guided by several criteria and factors, but one of those is the evaluation of potential routes that would use or parallel existing railroad or highway rights-of-way, and then also when appropriate for another consideration. The PUC will consider problems raised by other state agencies, federal agencies, or local entities. And as mentioned earlier, as far as the commission as the controlling authority, once it's made a decision, 216E10 indicates that state agencies are bound by the decisions made by the commission. And finally, Subdivision 3 of 216E10 requires state agency participation in the different at the different phases in the route permitting process. I think at that point,
that's
I'm
it,
available
Mr.
for questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Yeah. Mr. Eknas, is this process working?
Mr. Eknas.
You made the switch. Mr. Chair and Senator, I think that the process works. I guess I would say that the authority over routing and siting was shifted to the commission in 2005. The CapEx projects are the first drivers, which would require significant participation on the part of the state agencies other than the DNR. They've been participating in all others. We have four projects. They're at different phases within the review process. I don't know all the details of the Brookings transmission line project, but I would say that it is my understanding that that agencies that are affected are participating. If that answers your question.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Mr. Eknas, so is every effort being made to use existing rights of ways at the current time?
Mr. Eknas.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't think that these projects the review process has gotten to the point certainly where the commission would be making these decisions. I would suggest that when you look at the Fargo to St. Cloud or the St. Cloud to Monticello, I think the proposed lines are substantially along existing rights of way. And to that extent, it would seem to me that the pre-application consultation between the applicant and the agencies has taken place and is taking place.
Yeah. If I might ask, Mr. Eknas, if you determine that there is, you know, a right-of-way issue where you're going to be along a highway, does the MnDOT then have to issue a permit for that to actually proceed?
Mr. Chair, I can only give you my impression on that, and that is that the commission would make a decision on routing, and then there would be subsequent permits that the applicant would need to get from the department. But my understanding is that the department would need to follow the decision of the commission as it's laid out in its order.
Thank you. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this might be down in Senator Rosen's district, but along I-90, they've built it looks like maybe a 169 line, and it's on the south side, but it's just outside the right-of-way. And so I'm curious, as I watch that being built and everything, being on the Transportation Committee, I understand how protective MnDOT is of their right-of-way. Is that probably, you know, it's probably right outside MnDOT's right-of-way. Do you think on a project like that, MnDOT was approached about that line running within the highway right-of-way and they decided they didn't like that or that the company just went outside the right-of-way on their own?
Mr. Eknas.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not sure that I can provide you with a good answer. I do know that the Department of Transportation has concerns regarding safety and other issues, but I don't know the specifics of the proposal you're speaking of. I'm sorry.
Yeah, maybe we could have Council Fuller add something to this as well.
Mr. Chair, members, This is a little confusing because one of the reasons why I think this bill came forward was that information was that there was a proceeding in 2005 before the PUC and it issued a route permit that included right-of-way, and that then subsequently wasn't used because the right-of-way permits weren't issued. So that would, so there's some confusion anyway about that. Is that, Mr. Eckes, is that not an accurate representation of what happened in 2005? Or?
Mr. Eckes.
Mr. Chair, Council, I'm not absolutely sure of the specific dates, but that route permit was issued by the Environmental Quality Board. It was not before the commission. It was not issued by the commission. The commission made the decision on the certificate of need on that project, but it was in front of the Environmental Quality Board.
Now, Mr. Directors, did they have not have the same effect, though, whether it's the PUC or the EQB or whatever making that issue, that there should have been able to move forward? Or is there a conflict in these rules and ways we're doing that we're not, no matter what you do, we're going to have a problem? So because if they didn't issue the permits and it's based on their rules, we need to find out what the conflict is here. Do you know what that conflict might be?
Mr. Chair, I'm afraid that my point in saying that it was Environmental Quality Board, yes, we operate under the same rules, but it was with a different agency, and I don't know the history of that item.
Can you get MnDOT up here?
Can you answer this question?
Okay.
I believe I can, yeah. If I understand it.
Let's move on with the testimony at this point, then.
Mr. Chair, there's a speaker Senator here Prentice, that could probably answer that question.
Yes. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair. I'm Deborah Pyle with the Office of Energy Security, Thank Energy you. Facility Permitting. And I do indeed supervise the group that handles the routing and siting issues. And this is the same group that was with the Environmental Quality Board prior to the transfer of that routing and siting authority. And I think the project that you're referring to, indeed the Environmental Quality Board did issue a permit that specifically designated the location of the poles as being a certain number of feet outside the MnDOT right-of-way. Essentially, that would call for some overlapping of the rights-of-way, which was fairly common in permits in past times. And then when there was after the permit was issued and then the applicant did go to the Department of Natural Transportation for the specific permit to use part of that right-of-way, that's when the real detailed engineering came into play and there was really changes that had to be made in order to really accommodate the placement of these two rights-of-way together.
And so, Ms. Pyle, there was no resolution found for the conflict between those, and that ended the conversation at that point, just stopped everything, or what?
Mr. Chair, no, the resolution was found, but it was found after the permit was issued. And I think what we're really trying to do now is take care of and really explore those things in more detail during the permit development and issuance process.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Prentice-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pyle, do you know why this process wasn't used with the Brookings project? Why they weren't using existing right-of-ways?
Ms. Pyle.
Mr. Chair and Senators, the Brookings project is an open docket, so there really isn't a selected route yet at this time. There's a variety of routes on the table, and the hearings on that project have just ended. Once that process really finishes, then we will be looking at the record and making a recommendation to the Public Utilities Commission. But there at this point isn't a permit out there. Some of the routes indeed do follow existing rights of way. But the routes are large at this point, 1,000 feet, so the degree to which there is possibly overlapping of right-of-way is yet to be determined.
Okay. Senator
Mr. Chair, Ms. Pyle, but isn't it true that that the eminent domain process has already been used in the Brookings project?
Ms. Pyle.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not aware of that. It's not an area that we get into.
Okay, thank you. We'll go continue on with our other testifiers. Is it Preeti Patel? Please come forward. Thank you, and I'll ask you just to identify yourself for the record, and then the floor is yours. It's on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Preeti Patel, and I'm the co-executive director of CapEx 2020. Many of you have heard of CapEx 2020. It's an organization that's a joint initiative of 11 entities that provide electric service to a majority of the customers in Minnesota and the surrounding region. And just briefly, the purpose of our efforts is to expand the electric transmission grid to ensure reliable service and to provide transmission capacity that's needed to support new generation outlet. And I'm pleased to have this opportunity today to speak on behalf of the CapEx utilities and to support Senate File 2589. The routing of transmission lines, as you've just heard from Mr. Eknas, is a long and complex process. And our goal is pretty simple. We want to obtain state permits in a manner that allow us to build these lines on time and on budget. And we can't do that if we end up getting state permits that conflict. So in order for the Public Utilities Commission to avoid issuing a permit that eventually conflicts with a permit issued by another state agency, the commission needs to fully understand whatever concerns or requirements that other affected agencies have. And the only way to achieve that is for all the affected state agencies to participate in a route permit proceeding before the commission and to identify whether the site or route that's being proposed is consistent with or conflicts with their own standards, policies, or rules. And when we all participate in a single forum, we avoid conflicting permits, we avoid delaying the project, and we avoid eventually increasing costs to our ratepayers. So in the end, the CapEx utilities aren't interested in seeking a route permit or actually seeking a route that is in violation of any agency's rules. We'd prefer that all of the affected agencies be overtly present in a routing case, so that informed and consistent decisions can be made. And the bill proposed by Senator Prettner-Solon represents a sharp appreciation and understanding of the importance of agency participation in routing proceedings, as well as the importance of corridor sharing when the commission finds it reasonable. Section 1 of Senate File 2589 recognizes that there is a preference to use existing corridors for new transmission. Of course, when you read this section, it also states that the preference should be read in conjunction with existing Subdivision 7, which allows the commission to strike a balance, the right balance, in any given situation. And Section 2 of the bill recognizes the importance of the partnership between the commission and the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And this ensures that the permits that are issued are compatible and not inconsistent. So we believe that this partnership has been, as folks have mentioned today, more recently been occurring between the Department of Transportation, the staff, we believe all of the utilities in the CapEx processes, and it's been an important part of the transmission line routing proceedings. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Ms. Patel. Thank you very much. Questions from members? My question to you, just so I understand it completely, does the CapEx organization make a recommendation to the PUC to as far as what the preferred routes would be and then let them investigate that? How does that procedure work? Or do you wait for the PUC to come to you? What's the relationship?
We make a route application. The CapEx utilities that are participating in a specific line, there's four lines, we go ahead and we make a permit application to the commission.
Okay.
And we propose routes. But before we get to that stage, we've actually been in works trying to figure out what those routes should be, where they should be, through a very long process that can take up to a year prior to that. Where we consult with various stakeholders, including state agencies as well.
And Ms. Patel, you're following these particular guidelines, like using utility corridors existing in highways and right-of-ways as part of that process?
Yes, we look at all of the factors that the statutes and the rules lay out.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, so Ms. Patel, then sounds to me that you're making every effort to use existing corridors, but I have a very large contingency in my district that would say otherwise. What am I missing then? It seems like we're getting, the lines seem to be going across farm fields and front yards and backyards, et cetera. So, I heard you speak of the DOT, the commission, and Excel, but I don't think you mentioned the landowners, farmers, as maybe as much as we should have. But
and that's inadvertent on my part, absolutely inadvertent, because we have had many public meetings, many consultations with landowners and all of the communities that we affect. I mean, we make painstaking efforts to do this. And I have folks here that could actually attest to being at many of those public meetings. There isn't a simple formula that I can give you that says we will absolutely do the same thing on every line that we propose to construct. There isn't a single formula, which is why you have all of these factors that are laid out in the rules and statutes that allow you to balance a variety of interests, including the landowner interests, absolutely. And sometimes you will find landowners who will. The one thing we have come to realize in these proceedings, and particularly in the CapEx matters, is that there is oftentimes not a single landowner voice. And so you do have to take each situation as its own situation and find out what landowners in the communities want, what are the factors that they may consider to be important to them. Are their homes located right on a state highway? Or are they not? It all depends on where they live, absolutely what you're saying. But we do have many interactions with them, and our goal is always to weigh these factors in a way that we think is compatible for that given project.
Other questions from the committee? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Prettner-Solon, why did you want to take out the railways?
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Okay. I think maybe Council Fuller can address that one.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, there's a couple of reasons. One is that we just weren't familiar with the issues that had to do with railways. We had been brought to us by people who are involved with highway right-of-ways, so it seemed like we didn't fully understand that. We were approached by the railroad industry, who said there was some electric current that's critical to use low voltage in the rails to operate signals and crossings, and it could interfere with that. So, and then finally, there are public railway right-of-ways that are now often being used for bike trails and hiking trails. So it just seems like, you know, what brought it to the attention of the author was the highway right-of-ways. And we didn't really have a full understanding of the issues associated with railroads. So at this time, the judgment was to take it out and gather more information.
And Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I just want to, I'm looking at this handout, which doesn't really list the whole statute in it, but it does, it has a couple of excerpts, and it mentions that the current law says the PUC has to evaluate potential routes that would use or parallel existing railroad and highway rights of way. So it just, I thought it would make sense to have parallel kinds of rules in terms of preferences. So.
You have an answer? Okay. Senator Anderson, I think Council Fuller has another response to answer your question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, the reason is that we now elevated it to a preference. Mm-hmm. And so that law still exists that they have to consider it. But to make it a preference would have meant we would have information that had to justify that. And we didn't feel that we had that information with respect to railroad right-of-ways. And there have been more discussions about highway right-of-ways. So it was raising it to a preference. So it still is considered.
Senator Chair. Dibble.
To that point, Mr. Chair, I'm glad, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, that Senator Prettner-Solon took that out. We have an issue that goes right through the heart of Minneapolis, where they're trying to site high voltage power lines along a railway. And it's not just about that specific issue, but the whole set of issues for me that get raised when you put high voltage power lines along railways that may be making use of LRT or passenger rail or commuter rail, and get those high voltage power lines in place and the associated land use and development may really be impinged, the possibilities that are made possible from those forms of transit, I think, might be negatively impacted in the future. So I was glad that came out. I mean, it's a different matter out in the countryside, perhaps along freight rail lines, but particularly in urban commuter, passenger, and LRT settings, to elevate this to a preference creates some implications.
Thank you, Senator Senchum. You had a comment or question?
Well, just and Mr. Chair, and I don't know if anybody can answer this. Mr. Fuller indicated some level of study might go forward on rail, and I don't know who would do that. But my question, basically, if will we know any more about this rail issue before the end of session? I mean, and I'm thinking, and perhaps for those of you on the Transportation Committee know better than I, but in terms of the rail plan and how that maybe unfolds. And I'm just thinking in terms of my own situation, although not likely perhaps, if there were high-speed rail from Rochester to Twin Cities, that would seem to me a beautiful place for the CapEx line. And obviously not unlike what Senator Dallas said, there's a lot of issues with where it's going right now. And it just seems to me it would eliminate some level of controversy.
Senator Brennan-Solin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Senchum. It doesn't prevent them from still looking at lines at those right-of-ways, mm-hmm. if that's a potential. And as Mr. Fuller said, this bill only raises the highway right-of-ways as a preference. I do know that in my area, most of our railway lines are being used for biking and hiking trails, and I'm not sure that that's the best place for those high-voltage lines either.
Any other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Prettner-Solin. But on line 110, it says to utilize the route to the greatest extent. I think you could actually put comfort language in there to make it a sensible designation of railway lines. Because I do think Senator Senchum is onto something. I mean, there are possibilities, especially out in greater Minnesota, Senator Dibble, to you too. So, but my real thought or question is there any guidance from the federal government on this, or what are the other states? They must be grappling with the same situation too, and it seems like we are trying to, perhaps there is some guidance or from what the other states are doing or what the feds can give directives. I don't know.
Senator Rosen, it's my understanding that this is modeled after law in Wisconsin, so they are, I guess, working on the same issue. I don't know if that helps us any. Is there anyone else that can offer any additional answers?
Okay. There was a hand up right there.
Let me come to the table and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Paula Maccabee, and I've represented citizens on a number of routing matters, the MinCan pipeline and two different sections of the CapEx power line. I represent citizens on one part of the CapEx power line where the utilities did not offer the route from Freeport to St. Cloud that goes along the interstate highway, and instead have offered a much longer route that goes through a lot of farms and wetlands and environmentally sensitive areas. And then I represent citizens in another area where the utilities proposed a route that goes along what is a street that is designated as a state highway. It's not an interstate, even though that street puts three times as many people within 150 feet of the power line and more than twice as many people in that little neighborhood within 500 feet of the power line. So I guess my perspective is that it is a really important thing to get the agencies working together, but the preference, my sense, should be restricted to the interstate where there is a wide right-of-way, because sometimes the things that we call highways are really two-lane roads, and all the homes in the neighborhood, in a rural area particularly, are right up against that highway, sometimes the school and the church. In our case, it's a temple.
Ms. Maccabee, do you know what other states are doing, though?
Wisconsin's statute is closer to a preference than ours. I'm not sure that is a better law, though. I think Minnesota has done a very good job of incorporating a number of factors which have to do with how it affects human settlement, how it affects agriculture, how it affects the environment, and having consideration of being on the same right-of-way as being part of that calculus. I wouldn't say that Wisconsin's law is necessarily preferable to ours in terms of reducing the impacts on the people and the farmers and the schools or homes that happen to be near these proposed lines.
Okay. Senator Dibble, did you have a follow-up?
No, I'm fine.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Ms. McAbee, for helping us draw a distinction. I think we were visualizing interstates, state highways are very different from interstates, so we probably do need to think about that. Senator Prentner-Sullen, as we move on, perhaps to...
Do we have enough interstates, though, to... I mean, it may be that we need to use other rights-of-ways besides the interstate, too.
But I do want, Mr. Chair, to be sensitive to this issue that Ms. McAbee raises, and that is state highways do have a lot of property abutting. And it's not just, you know, I know people fear high-voltage lines for all kinds of reasons that may or may not be, you know, borne out by the evidence, but to be sure, there are huge implications for development and future development and land use, and that's kind of what I'm focused on. But I think you asked a question. Maybe we can answer it later. There was a question kind of hanging in there about what FERC is doing on this subject, with, you know, if there's a national regimen that's coming down that we're aware of and can respond to, or if that's just going to be so far in the future that we should take action ourselves.
Well, Senator Dibble, I don't know if there's someone from the PUC or Ms. McAbee can answer that, or someone from Office of Energy Security has any clue that could address that issue.
I don't know the answer.
No? Okay. Well, we'll have to work in getting that answer.
All right. Thanks.
Find that out.
Mr. Chair, there are two other testifiers. Mr. Glahn wanted to testify, and also Dave Sikora.
Let's have Mr. Sikora come to the table and address the committee. Thank you very much for coming. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dave Sikora, and I work on the staff of the Office of Chief Counsel at the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and I have been involved in the proceedings that involve the applications by CapEx 2020 for designation of routes for their high-voltage transmission lines. MnDOT has been an active participant in those proceedings, the applications from before they were filed, and now we're actively involved in the development of the record at the Public Utilities Commission. We understand the concerns of landowners who live along the routes that are being proposed. We have great respect for their situation where their land is being affected by these routes. And we agree that it is in the public interest to minimize the human, environmental, and economic impact of these new high-voltage transmission lines, and that one potential way to accomplish some mitigation is to locate the lines along highways or existing corridors when this can be done without impairing the safe and efficient operation of a highway. Our objective in participating in the Public Utilities Commission proceedings is to make sure that information gets into the record before the Public Utilities Commission so that it is as complete and clear as possible when they are making their decision on designating a route. And we have endeavored to provide detailed written information as well as oral testimony in the proceedings that have occurred to date. It's important, I think, for me to point out that MnDOT does have a formal written policy and procedures for accommodating utilities across and along trunk highways. This policy applies to all types of utilities. That includes high-voltage transmission lines, but it includes other types of gas, communications, water, sewer, other utilities. The department has substantial resources dedicated to responding to requests by utilities for use of the public right-of-way for their operations. And we have countless locations on highways all across the state where we've successfully accommodated requests by utilities. We hope that nobody who's affected by these proposals is under an impression that MnDOT doesn't work hard to accommodate the utilities. We don't think that would be an accurate assessment. We're working very hard to accommodate all sorts of utilities wherever we can. Our approach to the CapEx 2020 proposals has been to work to accommodate the utilities within or as near as feasible to the highway rights of way based on an evaluation of each specific location to ensure that it's suitable for this purpose and consistent with our legal responsibilities. MnDOT has a responsibility to design, build, and maintain trunk highways that are safe for the traveling public. And the location of these utility structures could, if they're not placed in a thoughtful location, have a significant impact on the safety of the road. Likewise, MnDOT has a responsibility to make sure that the men and women who work on and build and maintain highways have a safe place to work. When they're operating a large piece of equipment out along the highway right-of-way, they should not have to risk coming into contact with a high-voltage electric wire. Again, thoughtful consideration should be given to the placement of the poles. And MnDOT also has a responsibility to comply with transportation laws and be a responsible steward of the public investment in the transportation infrastructure. This includes giving careful consideration to matters such as reasonably anticipated changes to the configuration of a highway. I think the utilities agree with us that it doesn't make sense to locate a high-voltage transmission pole in a place where an interchange may be built in a few years, only to need to spend more money to relocate that at a future point in time. The current law on selection of a route for a high-voltage transmission line identifies a number of considerations for the Public Utilities Commission to evaluate. Potential routes that would use or parallel existing highways, as has been pointed out earlier, is one of those considerations that they're expressly required to consider. And as I've indicated, MnDOT agrees that it's appropriate that highways be included in that evaluation by the Public Utilities Commission. And as you look at the routes that CapEx has proposed, many of them run for long distances along highways. And we think that's a strong indication that the existing law is doing what it's supposed to do and bringing those kind of situations forward for study and evaluation. And we're providing input on those. As we've also heard some discussion here, each situation along a road is unique. Not all roads are the same, and we need to evaluate each situation for whether it's appropriate for placement of these facilities. While we feel that the current law is working as it's intended, we understand that the intent of this bill is to try to improve that process, and we've had some concerns about the language that I would like to share with you. One of the concerns that we have has been addressed by the amendment that related to the language at the bottom of the first page, sections 1 and 2, and I think the amendment addresses that. We have a concern about the terminology used on line 1.12, and it uses the term right-of-way rather than the term corridor, which is used on line 1.11. Right-of-way is a term that has a lot of specific meanings in the highway construction business, and its use could have unintended impacts on the placement of the high-voltage transmission lines. We think corridor would also be a better description at that place, perhaps with a description or a definition of corridor. And finally, we have some concerns about whether we think the bill should include some criteria for how one applies the concept of giving a preference to certain potential routes and when exceptions to such a preference may be appropriate. Without such guidance, we believe that there would be an ambiguity in the law that would lead to difficulty in applying the law. Let me give a couple of examples. As was mentioned by some earlier speakers, each highway has different characteristics. Some highways run through the middle of the populated areas of communities, and giving a preference to that highway would lead to an immediate problem of how do you apply it in that situation. There are 22 routes within the state that have been designated as scenic byways, and we're uncertain about how this would apply to highways with that characteristic. And also, many highways in the state run through areas such as Indian reservations, state or national forests, and public parks. We think that it would be useful to have some specificity in the law about how it would apply in those circumstances, and without that, it could have some unintended effects. We would like to work with Senator Pretner-Solon to try to improve this bill. We look forward to further discussions, and I thank you for the opportunity to offer some comments to you today.
Thank you, Mr. Sikora. I was curious, on the when you're going through your checklist of different things, criteria to appropriate routing, I mean, is there a hierarchy of considerations with safety? Is it cost considerations, the change that might potentially be happening in that roadway? Do you have a thing that's more important than another?
Mr. Chair, safety is always on everybody's number one priority. And we look at that, obviously, on every situation. But we do have obligations that we need to look at all matters that relate to the highway. There are questions that come up about what the financial impact may be to the highway system of a particular location. We'll take those into consideration, but I think safety would be top of the list.
Okay, so in most cases, if you've got a freeway system, I mean, I can see that maybe that's you've got a wide right of way on either side that, you know, putting something there wouldn't impose on safety issues too much. But in general, then in a lot of cases, we get closer to the metropolitan area, say, where there isn't a wide area to work with. It's a lot safer then to run across fields and the like and away from the roadways. Would that be correct,
Mr. Chair? As I said earlier, we look at each situation on its own merits. Each situation may have its own particular twists and turns. As a general matter, we tend to have wider rights of way in many rural areas, but that's not always the case. Even with interstate highways, the widths of the right of way will vary, even on the same highway, from mile to mile along the highway. And there's a number of historical reasons why that may have occurred. So we need to look at the width of the highway, what's adjacent to the highway, are there bodies of water that constrain the highway in a given area. And we even see there is one circumstance, the one that was mentioned in South Minneapolis, where there's a proposal to construct a high-voltage line. One of the routes that is under consideration in the environmental impact statement, in fact, would run along Hiawatha Avenue, which is a state trunk highway, Highway 55, follow the right-of-way of Interstate 94 right at downtown Minneapolis, and then follow the right-of-way of 35W. It's a very tight situation, and it raises questions about how would a preference for that highway be applied in that situation. I don't know. It's something that I think is a challenge.
Yeah, thank you. Senator Dipple.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I was just looking at the existing statute designating sites and routes, this handout here. Mm-hmm. I think we all have, I'm not sure, 216E.03. You know, there's actually some good on the second page, subdivision 7, about a little more than halfway down, the considerations in designating sites and routes. I haven't looked at it that closely, but there's some good criteria listed there, so perhaps the solution is to refer this preference language to that language. We might need to bolster or strengthen that language.
Senator Dibble, that is in the policies to the extent consistent with the policies of Subdivision 7. Give preference though to these others.
in the
Subdivision 7A.
Yep. So we're still keeping consistent with that.
Well, perhaps the entire subdivision should be considered. Because I think in paragraph B, there's land use, air and water resources, public health and welfare, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prentice-Solon.
The next stop for this bill will be in transportation, so I'm sure it'll get a complete airing at that time.
It appears to me, though, Mr. Sikora, that in general that you don't, all things being equal, that this is something that MnDOT can work with, and any small differences in language or use of words are things that you can work with the author on.
We welcome an opportunity to work with an author on smoothing out what we perceive to be some wrinkles in this bill.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any further questions from members? Then I think we have Mr. Glahn to come forward and our final testifier. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for having this opportunity and noting the late hour. I'll try to be as brief as I can. And I just want to do three things. I want to first thank Senator Prentice-Solon for bringing this forward. I think this is a useful exercise. And as you all have all heard me say over and over and over again, I believe as the acting reliability administrator that the number one challenge facing Minnesota is a deficit in our investment in high voltage transmission lines. And again, I won't go through my whole speech on that, just to say that a lot of what we're trying to accomplish, whether it be renewable energy, whether it's reliability, whether it's cost-effective energy supplies, is reliant on making significant upgrades to these high-voltage interstate transmission lines. So I believe that the effort that Senator Prentice-Solon is undertaking will help that. And so we support this effort. And I did want to also assure the committee that we have been working with the Department of Transportation, and I'd throw in the Department of Natural Resources in as well. We've been working with these agencies and the Public Utilities Commission to try to get these lines sited in a way that has the least impact on whether it's the traveling public or the outdoors community or local landowners. And we believe that we've established good working relationships with these agencies, and certainly through the end of this administration, look forward to continuing those good relationships. So I want to thank Department of Transportation, their senior management, the commissioner, the deputy commissioner, and all the way down to the district engineers have been very helpful in this effort. I did want to thank them in a public forum for that. And the last thing I wanted to do was to address a question Senator Dahl had asked before. And I don't know if I can directly address the specifics of the situation in your district, but I would say that the process that we have for high-voltage transmission lines specifically is that an applicant has to come in and put forward at least two alternative routes. And in doing that, we have a struggle that we go through in we want to give landowners who could potentially be affected by this as much notice as we possibly can. So we want them not to hear We want them to hear sooner rather than later. There could be a project that would affect their property. So what we end up doing, unfortunately, is in the end notifying perhaps thousands of landowners, or at least hundreds of landowners, who in the end may not be affected at all because a different route would have been chosen. So I don't know if that entirely explains the phenomenon that you observed. And I can't give any assurance to Senator Dahl that that the line that your constituents are concerned about will not affect them. But we do have that process where we ask the utility to come in with at least two alternative routes and then end up notifying anybody who might be affected by those alt routes or any variations of those routes in particular locales. So we end up alarming a lot of folks who in the end aren't affected by it, but we've decided it's better that folks hear sooner rather than later that this project is coming, and that's the direction we've taken with that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I end my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Glahn. Question, Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Glahn, for your comments. And I think you did touch on some of my issues, and I think as Senator Prettner-Solon mentioned right away, we really are trying to find a balance between landowner rights and the need for transmission, and I've never said that I'm opposed to transmission. I agree with that, but I believe that obviously we are going to revisit the issue of what do landowners' rights mean and what is the cost of fairness in all of this. So we're trying to find a balance, and that's really my issue.
That's an important one, too. Further questions from the committee? Mr. Glenn, thank you. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 2589 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Transportation.
On that motion, any questions or comments from the committee? Seeing none, then, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.